I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Barack Obama's top economic advisor, Lawrence Summers, says he's confident the economy will turn around. And CNN is calling Obama the confidence builder in chief after he said yesterday, things aren't as bad as we think. Well, let's start today with a weekend financial roundup. Teetering Citigroup said it doesn't need additional government bailout money. Citi and Bank of America now say they're turning profits. The stock market has had 3 days of rallies. But last night, Daily Show host Jon Stewart went mano a mano with CNBC business analyst Jim Cramer after more than a week of lampooning Cramer and CNBC for cozying up to Wall Street in the past, telling investors to put their money in firms such as Bear Stearns that within days melted down.
There are literally shows called Fast Money.
Well, I think that there's a market for it, and you give it to them, and I think
there's
a
market for cocaine and hookers.
Well,
Peter Coy is economics editor for Business Week magazine. Peter, so where are we now? We don't want to be lampooned by Stewart and be too optimistic again, but, you know, we had those rallies on Wall Street.
Oh, I wish I knew. I mean, things are just crazy out there. Every time you get some really bad news, then somebody comes along with some good news, and then it's back to the bad news again. No wonder people are completely befuddled. And I include the economists in that group of the befuddled.
Well, and the Wall Street rally, the question is that good news? Or what's called a dead cat bounce? You know, it looks like it's turning around, but it's still, well, you know, dead.
Yeah, well, the news that the banks are able to turn a profit on their current operations has to be seen as a positive. I mean, I'd rather see this than see them losing money on operations. What this doesn't say is that the banks are out of the woods. Remember, they're still on artificial life support from the government. Take those away, and they'd be out of business tomorrow.
Well, let's get to just other economic news this week. Bernard Madoff woke up in prison today. Prosecutors had reportedly offered him a plea deal under which he would have had to admit conspiracy. He refused. He pled guilty. And does that mean we may never find out any more about the Ponzi scheme, how it operated, where the money is?
I think prosecutors are determined to keep digging in, even without his cooperation. And we may not find out every jot and tittle about his fraudulent accounting, but I hope we can get our hands on some more of the money to compensate the victims, at least in part. It is worth saying, by the way, that people didn't actually lose $65 billion in money out of their pockets. Mm. A lot of that was a valuation, a false valuation in the first place. So if you gave him $1 million, he told you had $5 million, then the government would say, you know, that you were defrauded by $4 million. But you never really had that in the first place, and you wouldn't have gotten if you put your money elsewhere. Even if they dug up all of it, it would be way less than $65
billion. Right. We've heard, by some accounting, $14 billion. Still a lot of change for some people.
Yeah.
Well, we just want to know, what are you watching? You know, what are the economic indicators you're watching for signs of how long, how deep this recession is going to be?
One is growth abroad, because the United States is not going to be able to climb out of this recession alone. I saw something very alarming yesterday, which didn't get a lot of publicity. The Swiss government, the Swiss National Bank, is trying to depreciate its currency. This reminds me of the beggar thy neighbor policies that worsened the Great Depression. I just hope that attitude does not spread around the globe.
Oh, explain that to us. Depreciate its currency. Isn't this what the U.S. accuses China of doing?
Exactly. And China has a massive surplus with the U.S. that actually grew, even though our deficit with the rest of the world shrank.
Yeah. Well, just taking a look inside the U.S. today, economic advisor Larry Summers also said that the U.S. is in a cycle, that we need 14 million new car sales every year. We're only at 9. That we need almost 2 million new housing units built. We're at 400,000. But he said, you know, it is a cycle. And he also believes that with tax cuts, wage increases, and loosening credit, the U.S. will pull out of this problem over the next 5 years. It sounds as if both he and Obama are basically asking for time.
It is true. This is not a problem that's going to be solved overnight. But as Summers says, if you are drastically under the kind of baseline production of housing you need, the baseline production of autos, then you have to think at some point there's going to be a catch-up here. When that catch-up starts, suddenly production rises, and that creates an upward spiral instead of the downward spiral that we're in now.
In other words, you're saying that eventually cars break down and Americans will need to buy cars.
That's right. Consumers and businesses eventually need new stuff. you can only put it off so long. Once you start buying, you know, taking some of that money you've been hoarding in your bank account and spending it again, it creates a virtuous upward spiral where the money you spend goes to businesses they're able to hire. That puts money in the pockets of other people. They can spend, and off we go.
Peter Coy, economics editor for Business Week magazine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, that may be, but the Federal Reserve reports today that American households lost $5.1 trillion in the last 3 months of 2008, 9% of their wealth, the most ever lost in a single quarter in 57 years. And a recent Pew Research study found that 78% of self-described middle-class Americans say they're having trouble maintaining their standard of living. Well, President Obama formed a middle-class task force to try to address their problems, and today we want to spend a few minutes with the executive director of that group to ask, what is a middle-class American today, and what can be done specifically to help them? Jared Bernstein is also Vice President Joe Biden's chief economic advisor. Before that, he was senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. He joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be here.
Well, tell us first, what is your definition of a middle-class American?
You know, it's a funny thing. Economists don't have a standard definition of the middle class. Certainly, it's the broadest part of the income scale because the middle comprises a large swath of people. It would definitely include the median, which for households now is about $50,000. Certainly, there are families that earn a little bit less than that that you might call middle class and families that earn twice that much. Mm-hmm. The way I like to describe it, Robin, is not based on an income cutoff. I think it's based on a set of aspirations that historically middle-class people have felt really make sense to them. So, for example, the ability to afford a decent house in a good neighborhood with a public school that you're happy to send your kids to, the ability to save for your kids' college, the ability to depend on reliable and affordable health care, the ability to put something aside for a pension. You might take a vacation, but it's not going to be to Machu Picchu. It might be to visit Aunt Gladys in Cleveland, but that's part of your budget as well.
Well, let's hold you up right there, because vacation, pension, health care, ability to save for college, mm-hmm. you know, ability to afford a home in a neighborhood with schools that you like. I can hear listeners ticking through all of those and saying, you know what, I'm having trouble with all of those. And you don't want to put a number on it, but some economists have said middle class is $30,000 to $100,000 mm-hmm. a year. And we understand that, you know, families of four living on $30,000 a year in parts of this country don't feel like they're in the middle class. They're struggling. And families of four with kids in college making, you know, even $150,000, way over what the range is in some cities, are also struggling. They don't feel like they're upper class.
You tick through that list, a decent house, good neighborhood, reliable public school, health care, pension. You tick through that list, and you're absolutely right. There are going to be a lot of families out there who say, boy, that is a much heavier lift than it used to be, than it should be, than I expected it to be, given that we're playing by the rules. We're working harder and smarter. We're helping to boost the American economic pie, or at least we were when the economy was expanding, and yet we're running faster to stay in place. That precisely is the economic and political space wherein this task force was created.
Well, let's take some of the issues one at a time and ask what you're going to do about it. Wages. Tell us you know, what you see when you look at the middle class regarding wages.
Well, right now I see a middle class, not to mention lots of other folks, who are struggling with an extremely unforgiving economy in the midst of a tough recession. And so one of the first things you have to do to help people get their wages up is to get jobs growing again. And that gets to the heart of the $787 billion stimulus package that, by the way, is the focus of our next middle class task force meeting, which is going to take place on Thursday, March 19th. The point of the central theme of that meeting will be to look into this Recovery Act and pull out all the pieces that help middle-class families. And in the context of the question you just asked, we're talking about 3.5 million jobs between now and the end of next year saved or created by this package. Getting the unemployment rate down, and we think we can bring the unemployment rate down a couple of points relative to where it would be otherwise, is one of the best ways to help people.
We know that a focus of the task force is green jobs, billions of dollars to help create jobs in wind, solar, other renewable energy fields. And we know you spoke of that in a middle-class task force meeting in Philadelphia. Van Jones was there. He's been on this program. He's been pushing to get the inner city moving into green jobs. We spoke to a community college in California this week, training people to work in the wind turbine business. And it sounds great for, you know, the out-of-work construction workers we spoke to who, you know, had been making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 and thought that was going to happen forever. But, you know, even if you put all the, you know, the three community colleges now who are trying to retrain out-of-work middle-class workers to go into clean energy, that's about 100 jobs. How are you going to make this leap to green jobs helping out the middle class?
The market's going to create some of those jobs itself, and you're right, it's not going to be overnight. But it is clear to me as an economist, having nothing to do with my political hat that I'm wearing these days, that this is where the economy, where labor demand is headed by necessity. We have to start addressing carbon emissions, global warming, climate change, and therefore the economy will serve up opportunities in this area, but it won't serve up enough on its own. That's why a government needs to make significant seed corn investment in green jobs. We have more than $11 billion for investments in the new smart grid in the recovery package, $500 million for job training. There's a $6 billion loan guarantee program that can be leveraged up to many multiples of that. On its own, the market may well underinvest in these jobs, so we recognize the role that we have to play.
Well, and will these new jobs close another gap that we know you've noted? I asked about wages, but, you know, meaning incomes. Middle-class incomes have fallen by, what, $2,000 in 10 years? Why are wages so, not just stagnant, but falling, and what can you do to change that?
Well, right now, wage pressures are coming very much from an economy and particularly a job market that's losing jobs at a very steep rate. We're in the midst of a tough recession. That always leads to higher unemployment, puts downward pressure on wages. I think the more important question is, how is it that in a period when the unemployment rate was falling relatively low, when the economy's productivity was growing at 2.5% per year, which is a nice growth rate, as you said, the median income of working-age households fell $2,000. So even when times were good. The answer to that has to do with a set of factors that have come together to, in my view, really diminish the bargaining power of many workers in the middle class. They simply don't have the basic bargaining clout to tap in to what has long been a social contract that says if you work hard and you play by the rules, you will get your fair slice of the growing pie, the pie you yourself are helping to grow. There are numerous factors. Globalization has played a role. The decline in labor unions has played a role.
So are you saying the task force is going to recommend more unions?
The task force, it's not just the task force. President Obama and Vice President Biden said in a public forum the other day that a strong middle class depends on a strong labor movement. Mm-hmm. And one of the platforms that they ran on was the Employee Free Choice Act. This is a hotly debated policy, but I think the key thing for listeners to recognize is that this is not a policy that guarantees there's a lot more unions. This is a policy that guarantees that the playing field for those who want to form unions is level.
Okay, well, backers say the field is now tilted against unions, but others say the Free Choice Act would trade private elections for publicly signed cards. We note it still allows for private elections. We're going to leave it at that. By the way, later today, we're going to take a look at March Magic, but we're going to take a break and be back with Jared Bernstein of the Middle Class Task Force. Many more questions for him here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation with Jared Bernstein, head of the Obama administration's middle class task force. And Jared, I want to get to some of the other burdens that you mentioned are weighing down the middle class. Housing. We know the Obama plan is going to help homeowners trying to refinance but rejected by banks who have a limit on how much debt a homeowner can hold. The Obama plan helps, but it requires that a new mortgage can't exceed 105% of current market value. So if your mortgage is, say, $210,000, your property can't be worth less than $200,000. Now, home values have plummeted in parts of the country, and we hear all the time from listeners who say, Obama's plan cuts me out. You know, these are homeowners who want to pay their mortgages. They're not people with bad loans. They want more help.
The housing plan that we've introduced has two parts. One part is for the folks who've lost enough equity in their homes that they may be slightly underwater. So that means that your home may be worth slightly less than the debt that you owe on it, and you may be able to refinance thanks to this plan. But the other part of the plan, which we think is going to reach 4 to 5 million homeowners, is for people who may be a lot more deeply underwater, but with a modified loan can pay their mortgage and meet their monthly requirements. And so this is a very ambitious part of the plan that can lead to considerable loan modification for people facing that situation.
Well, let's move on to health care. Even Democrats are criticizing President Obama's $3.6 trillion budget. Senator Kent Conrad, chair of the Senate Banking Committee, says it's the deficits. They're not sustainable. And, you know, adding $634 billion in health care over the next 10 years is not responsible. And yet you have others. The Drum Major Institute, which follows middle class issues, says, you know, the government has got to do more with health care. There's got to be a public health care plan to compete with private health care, because this is one of the biggest burdens for the middle class.
In our first budget, the one you just mentioned, we didn't put health care in there and say, you know, here's an asterisk, pay for later. We actually generated the savings and the revenue to pay for every one of those $634 billion over 10 years.
Well, one of the ways Obama did it was to propose that, for instance, people making above a certain salary be able to deduct less of their mortgage interest from their taxes. And that brings us to another area. Some people are saying, well, maybe, you know, what your task force has to do may be even more unpopular with people. Why not, you know, take that away entirely? Why not maybe, you know, credit people more on a federal level who pay rent? Why not adjust the American dream a little bit so that maybe, you know, it's for everybody to have a home?
It's really important to recognize that we have suggested a marginal change in the ability to deduct contributions to charities, or in the case of homes that you mentioned, taking that deduction from 35 or 39% down to 28%. We believe we're doing the responsible thing, which is to raise the revenue behind our ideas. We also squeeze a couple of $100 billion out of inefficient spending in Medicare. And so it's one thing to criticize and say, you're creating too much deficits. Another criticize and say, well, you didn't go far enough in your revenue raising. I think it's a delicate balancing act, and I think we've tried to hold the line right down the middle there.
Well, Jared Bernstein, again, of the Middle Class Task Force, how much of what you have to do, in addition to finding reprieve for people in the middle class, how much is about the language that you just used? You said, you know, we're doing the responsible thing. How much is about getting that language out to people who we know are not saving, who are living above their means? We have a colleague who did a documentary on the middle class. He spoke to a couple making $150,000, struggling to pay the mortgage, $4,000 a month mortgage on a almost $800,000 house. Many people would say, what's a couple making $150,000 doing in a documentary on the middle class? Well, these are people who see themselves as struggling middle class. But how much does your task force have to address, are people living above their means?
The circumstances that we're in right now, the economic circumstances, are enforcing a very different set of behaviors by precisely those folks. I mean, let's face it, the household sector, many folks lived beyond their means. The corporate sector, the banking sector, way beyond their means. And that's obviously come crashing down. And what we're seeing now are people are really retrenching, really pulling back. I think where our task force comes into your question is that you simply can't run an effective, efficient, fair economy if people are working harder, yet they're falling further behind. I mean, one of the reasons these families went into debt, not all of them, of course there was irresponsible borrowing out there, but one of the reasons is because their incomes were flat and falling, and the only way they could keep their living standards rising was to borrow, and there happened to be cheap terms of credit and reckless underwriting standards and bad stuff that we're going to try to put an end to. But the fact is, at the core of this, the core of our task force, is to reconnect working families to a growing economy by creating a policy glue, an architecture that really has not been there for a while.
We understand just 6% of Americans make more than $97,000. There's also a smallish percentage of Americans who are really struggling at the bottom of the economic rung. This group we're talking about, the middle class, is huge. Do you see them going away? Do you see us going back to, you know, pre-World War II?
Absolutely not. I mean, the American middle class remains large. Our job is to get this economy percolating again in the short run, and we're on the case, both of the recovery package and some of the other pieces of the plan. With the middle class task force, we are working to, you know, help reinvigorate that dream and give these folks a chance to benefit from a broadly shared prosperity that's been missing in the economy for too long.
Jared Bernstein, we know you have to go. One quick last question. Your middle class task force has been criticized because there's no one in the middle class on it. Have you thought about bringing up your own version of whoever Joe Plumer might be, but, you know, somebody making 60, 70, putting him on the task force?
I will say this. It's really important for us to absolutely, as you suggested, interact with as many people we can. To do that, we have a blog on our website, astrongmiddleclass.gov. I read it. I respond to folks. So I would ask listeners to go there and share their ideas with us.
We'll link at our website. Jared Bernstein, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Economist Jared Bernstein, head of the Obama Administration Middle Class Task Force. We're going to take a break for the latest news and see you on the other side with the legacy of Dusty Springfield. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. You may have heard Paul Levy before on our program. He's CEO of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center here in Boston. He's called for more transparency in hospitals, for an open discussion of medical errors. He writes a blog. Well, recently he gathered his entire workforce in an auditorium and ran an idea by them. What if, instead of laying off low-wage workers, everyone take a salary and benefit cut, including about 10% cut from his own CEO pay? Well, Paul Levy is on the line. Paul, what was the reaction when you suggested that?
It was overwhelming and heartwarming. They said, you know, I've been thinking about this. What do you think? There was immediate sustained applause. Mm-hmm. And to tell you the truth, I teared up when I heard it. It was just, it was amazing.
Well, let's give the backstory here. The last time you were here, you said that hospitals in Boston in particular would take a big hit from the Madoff scandal because many area philanthropists lost money. And, of course, there's just the economy in general. What kind of a deficit are you facing at Beth Israel? Why were you even asking about how to cut costs?
We're not sure exactly yet, but it could be up to $20 million. For the year, which is a lot.
Well, Kevin Cullen, a Boston Globe columnist, wrote that in trying to think of how to prepare, you walked the halls while you were considering layoffs. What did you see?
Well, I see wonderful people. For example, the transporters, who are the people who push beds and wheelchairs around, probably have more contact with patients than anybody in the hospital, if you think about it. They're constantly doing that. And as they do, they talk to people. One of our transporters even sings to people as he's pushing beds along, and it calms them down. I like to say they practice medicine without a license. The food service folks, the housekeepers, and so on, are really part of the care delivery team here, and they take it very seriously.
Well, and you also know that many of them had been hired in the last few years and would be the jobs to cut. I mean, you're not going to cut the neurosurgeon. So you make the suggestion and get this response from the staff that maybe instead of cutting the low-wage workers, everyone takes a pay cut. And we also know you've been hearing from employees since. What are people saying about other ways to cut costs?
I've been getting about 100 emails an hour from staff members saying, I'm willing to give up my vacation time. I'm willing to give up my raise. I'm willing to take a furlough just to help the hospital save enough money so that we can reduce the number of layoffs.
Well, a couple questions. It's not news that you and the hospital have waged a very public battle with the SEIU Service Workers Union. They say you're preventing unions from organizing. And, you know, question, if you are so concerned, as you seem to be, with these low-wage workers, isn't providing them with a union a way to ensure them job security and benefits?
I want to make absolutely clear, we've not been preventing anybody from starting a union here. There's a process in place under federal law if they ever want to follow that process. And I'm not against unions per se. In fact, I was the person in Massachusetts who signed the largest single project labor agreement on a public works project.
Well, we'll put that aside. But what about the idea of across-the-board cuts? You suggested a 10% cut to your salary. You make a very healthy salary. Should the cuts be the same across the board? Somebody making $14,000, $18,000 a year, a 10% hit would be devastating.
Well, our senior managers have all volunteered to take a 5% cut in pay, and I've taken a 10% cut, plus I've gotten rid of the bonuses. So I think as a general matter, we need to be sensitive to wage levels. What might be good for a person earning $100,000 certainly wouldn't be good for someone earning $30,000.
So upper management is definitely taking pay cuts, but now, Paul Levy, you have to decide how to proceed from here, and it sounds as if, you know, maybe you will be able to keep from doing layoffs.
I know we'll be able to reduce the number of layoffs. I hope we don't have to do any. I know people will have to take a haircut on things like raises, on vacation time, and the like, but I'm not sure of the details yet.
And what about the idea of lowering wages, period? Some economists are saying, fine, at one or two companies, FedEx is considering this, but if it's across the board, it may contribute to the economic downturn by reducing the purchasing power of the very people who do tend to shop, the people with the lower income.
I think the struggle every corporation is facing is how to balance its own budget with the idea that we know that we would like people to earn a good salary and participate in the economy because that's important to stimulate the economy over time. And there's a tension between the two. I don't think we can ignore that.
Paul Levy, CEO of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Paul, thanks so much for taking some time for us.
A pleasure.
Okay, after a quick break. How about that game last night? You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. The NCAA tournament hasn't even begun, but the madness has already started. How about that game last night? Joining us in the studio, Bill Littlefield of Only a Game. And I just found out about the game today.
I'm so glad that was not a game that I had decided to stay up and watch.
Six overtimes.
Six overtimes didn't end until 1:22 this morning. Connecticut upset by Syracuse. And Connecticut had all kinds of chances to win the game, but Syracuse played better in the sixth overtime, and so they emerged the winner.
Right, this is the Big East tournament. Mm-hmm. Number 18, Syracuse, and number 3, Connecticut. That's pretty much of a shocker right there.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, this means the Syracuse team will now meet West Virginia tonight, and Syracuse hasn't had a lot of sleep in the Big East semifinals. West Virginia advances after, you know, upsetting number 2 Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So how is Syracuse going to do tonight?
Well, wouldn't it be great if they came out with a full court press and they played run and gun from the opening whistle? I mean, that would be the psych job of the century as far as I'm concerned, having played 6 overtimes and gotten no sleep to come out and try and play that way. I think they'll have to play very slowly, unless they have an exceptionally deep bench.
Yeah.
We'll see, I guess.
See how that goes tonight. And turning to the Big 12, second-seeded Oklahoma fell to Oklahoma State, 71-70, a squeaker there. Baylor stuns top-seeded Kansas, another one there. These conferences all lead up to this Sunday, Selection Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and then the big dance. So
yes, that's when we wait for whoever the bracket guy is to get his brackets out so that we all can make our best guesses, both educated and uneducated, about which teams will proceed to make the Grade 8 and the Final Four.
Do you want to make one now? Do you want to?
Oh, I can give you the women's champion right now.
Yes,
how's
you can.
That?
Go.
University of Connecticut women's team is undefeated. They won their conference.
Going out on a limb
they
here.
They won their Big East final by about 40 points. If they lose, as Charlie Pierce said last week, it'll be the biggest upset in the history of women's college basketball.
As short as it is.
Yes.
Let's turn to baseball, the World Baseball Classic, because you always go beyond the sports borders. Did the Netherlands actually beat the Dominican Republic?
They beat the Dominican Republic twice, 2-1 and 3-2. Nobody could believe the 2-1, and then really nobody could believe the 3-2. Dominican Republic, of course, is a veritable baseball factory. Zillions
right.
of major leaguers have come off the Dominican. And the Netherlands, well, let's see. They got a kid who's playing in the minor leagues for Detroit, who's not too bad. They got a lot of guys from Aruba and Curacao who nobody had ever heard of, but by golly, they have heard of them now.
Really something. They ended up losing to Puerto Rico, but they're going to advance to the second round and meet the U.S. and Venezuela, so suddenly all eyes will be on the Netherlands.
Yeah, they play Venezuela this weekend. They're in a group now with Venezuela, the U.S., and Puerto Rico, so that'll be tough
for them
to move beyond that.
Right.
But they've already had a heck of a tournament.
And the Dominican Republic now eliminated, so who's your favorite?
Well, that's hard to say. Japan is the defending champion, and, you know, the common wisdom is you got to beat the defending champion to win the tournament. Cuba, of course, very strong. Korea, very strong. I wouldn't count out Venezuela, and who knows? You know, the
maybe
U.S. may
Australia.
Be better than people think. Well, Australia.
Australia defeating Mexico.
Australia, unfortunately, having defeated Mexico, has now gone home. They did win a silver medal back in the 2004 Olympics in Athens. So there is a baseball community in Australia, and they had one big win. Unhappily, that was it.
Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game, taking us around the world in sports. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome, Robin.
The other night, I picked up some CDs for our next segment at the very hip Newbury Comics record store here in the Boston area. Dusty, the 20-something clerk said. Nice. It's rare that I can impress a record clerk, so I said, yep, I saw her once when I was a kid at the Fox Theater in Brooklyn. His head snapped up. No, sir! I Only Want to Be With You, Dusty Springfield's first solo hit in her native Britain and here in the States, where her huge blonde beehive, black eyeliner, and white lipstick was imitated by schoolgirls, and her voice, it might have helped break racial barriers, and it definitely seemed to break sound barriers. Dusty Springfield died in 1999 of breast cancer. What was her impact? Well, some of us hear a direct line from her to Britain's newest beehived singers, Adele and Amy Winehouse. For you, I was a flame. Love is a losing game. Annie Randall is an associate professor of musicology at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania, and she's taken a deep look at the impact of Dusty Springfield in a scholarly new book called Dusty, Queen of the Postmods. And Annie Randall joins us from the studios of Temple University outside Philadelphia. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, and we're thrilled to have an opportunity to play Dusty Springfield.
Absolutely.
Who was born a red-haired Mary O'Brien. She transformed herself into Dusty Springfield. And you tell us that while Dusty Springfield exploded in the U.S., fully formed, as you know the image we know, Britain watched her evolve. She was the girl next door who sang in the group The Springfields. Let's listen to a little of their hit, Silver Threads and Golden Needles. Silver threads and golden needles, can I mend this heart of mine? And I dare not drown my sorrow in the warm glow of your wine. Well, then Dusty Springfield goes out on her own and develops her look and her sound. Start with the look. Where did she pull that from?
She credited a number of sources. She was looking at, for instance, the world-famous blondes of this period, Catherine Deneuve in France, Kim Novak in the United States, Doris Day. And then French fashion models were really laying on the black eye makeup as well, so she pulled it from there. And she even, at one point, credited drag queens.
Yeah, she said she actually was a form of drag.
Yeah, she did say that.
Which becomes interesting later in her story, which we'll get to. But you write, the look was intoxicatingly liberating for a lot of her fans. Lulu, the To Sir With Love singer, said, you know, these fans were like the first wielders of girl power.
That look was just so different from what anybody else was doing in British pop at the time that it just unleashed something among teenage fans, boys and girls, actually.
Well, in fact, you spoke to a male fan years later who said she was like the leader of a gang I wanted to be in.
That's right.
But what about the voice? Elvis Costello describes it as the greatest in pop music. Here are some of the words that have been used to describe it. Rich, smoldering, dusky, with a rasp. Voice specialists refer to as vocal noise.
I don't know really what to make of it other than it probably has some emotional meaning for people listening to it. It possibly means she's human. She's a little damaged. And I think we can all identify with that. And, of course, the way Dusty used it to maximum dramatic impact, I think that, of course, makes the sale with most listeners. Knowing I love you so.
All right, we're going to take a minute break. We'll be back to hear more here and now. Welcome back. If you want a time for soul, baby, it's time for soul time. That's American soul singer Madeline Bell, who became a close friend of singer-songwriter Dusty Springfield in the 60s. They sang backup for each other. In fact, that's Dusty in the background on this song, Soul Time. And Professor Annie Randall of Bucknell University notes in her new book, Dusty, Queen of the Postmods, that as Dusty Springfield forged friendships with American soul singers, her voice became more soulful as well. Professor, have I got that right?
Well, they became very good friends, and I think Dusty had a very unusual, very sincere interest in not only black music, but black American culture, as anyone who knows her music will attest. I mean, it was just something that she identified with very, very strongly, and it became her signature style.
A form of soul singing, signifying, was something
right.
She picked up. As you said, she walked the walk. She was famously kicked out of South Africa because she refused to perform there because of apartheid.
Right.
She had her own television show in Britain, and she introduced these American soul singers to British audiences. She makes the CD Dusty in Memphis. Rolling Stone says it's one of the top CDs of all time. It had the hit Son of a Preacher Man. But it was a tough sell. She was too white for black audiences in the U.S., you write, but too black for white?
Yes, I think there was the racial divide there. Remember, it was the, you know, year of riots in the United States. I think it was just a very tough sell in 1969 for a white soul singer.
Yeah. Although she still had the hit. Let's listen to Son of a Preacher Man. When they gather around and started talking, Cousin Billy would take me walking out through the backyard, we go walking. Then he look into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what? Her voice is one thing, but her delivery is another. Her most famous song, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, was originally an Italian song.
This is still a hugely known song in Italy, and it's Io che non vivo più di un'ora senza te in Italian. And the original singer and one of the authors of it is Pino Donaggio, and he just does an amazing job singing this song. It's a flat-out, over-the-top, operatic-type pop aria. So che tu vuoi dirmi che non sei felice, che io sto cambiando e tu mi vuoi lasciare. Well, and when Dusty performs it, she has the aria element as well, but a physicality that you say has roots in 19th century acting styles. Any Dusty fan will instantly know what we're talking about here. It's the arm gestures. They're very...
dramatic.
Very dramatic, thank you. Very theatrical. I include pictures of these in my book, and a lot of Dusty fans who have seen those pictures have marveled at the similarities between Dusty's stage gestures and the pictures from 19th century actors.
Well, let's listen to a little, and we can all mime along. Everybody, back of your hand on your forehead, hands clasped at your chest,
arms flung out wide.
Right, flung out right. wide. You don't have to say. Annie Randall, in your final chapter, you explore Dusty Springfield's relationship with her fans. We know there was a Dusty tribute CD released in the U.S. by singer Shelby Lynn recently. There are still websites and blogs. Some of us listen to Adele, who just won the Grammy for Best New Artist, and we see Dusty. Why do you think it's such a strong legacy?
Well, you bring up the new crop of Britpop singers, you know, people like Adele, Amy Winehouse, Duffy, Joss Stone. They all talk about a debt to Dusty. Joss Stone named her dog after Dusty. She said she grew up listening to Dusty's songs and had memorized them word by word. I think Dusty represented something very original. She was very hip. She was very mod. She was very bold. And she's among the first women to ever produce her own records. She really staked out some ground for the female pop singer that simply wasn't there before Dusty did it.
The look of love is in your eyes, the look your heart can't disguise.
And one last item, we alluded to this. She also is, you know, performed around the world by drag queens, by men who dress up like Dusty Springfield with the big beehive wigs and the black eyeliner and the white lipstick and the gowns and the hand gestures and perform the music. And one thing that you discuss in a very scholarly way is the fact that Dusty Springfield was gay, and very few people knew it at that time. This was the early 60s. It certainly wouldn't have been a topic of conversation. And I'm wondering, you know, how much her fans picked up in her, well, perhaps a little bit of sadness. I don't know what it would be, but that she wasn't, I mean, not only was she not Mary O'Brien anymore, but she wasn't really being who she was.
Well, you know, Elton John was asked about this, and he says there's a certain torture that you can hear in Dusty's voice, you know, torment. And perhaps her own situation in her private life just accentuated this and heightened it even more, because I think Dusty was a natural actress and she could, you know, really live something. But I think the fact that she was also experiencing it personally probably just added that extra layer of passion to what she was singing, which couldn't be ignored by listeners. I think listeners were galvanized by what they heard, and they were stopped in their tracks by the passion of her singing.
Annie Randall writes about the life and music of the late, great Dusty Springfield in the book Dusty, Queen of the Postmods. Annie is Associate Professor of Musicology at Bucknell University. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Robin. It's really been fun talking to you.
Wishing and hoping and thinking and praying, planning and dreaming each night of his charms that won't get you into his arms. So if you're looking to find love, you can share. All you gotta do is hold him and kiss him and love him and show him that you care. Wishing and a hoping, just wishing.